Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Chris Murphy, the President of the United States has made a decision, and that is that we're going to have terrific change in our policy towards Cuba. There are people who are saying, hey, you know, they're just empowering the Castros. Back comes the answer, hey, for 50 years, what we've been doing doesn't work. And from a political point of view, the younger Cubans in Florida are saying, you know, we want this. We want to have these better relations with Cuba. Well, the older guys, the older folks are, you know, where they have been for a long time. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's the right call. I think it's long overdue. You know, at some point, you have to admit that, you know, over 50 years of policy hasn't worked, and so we should try something different. I mean, for those people who think that we should continue the embargo and continue the policy of isolation, they have not a scintilla of evidence that that policy actually works. It may make them feel better to ignore Castro and the regime, but it's not actually leading to any, you know, greater freedom for the people of that country. So that's, I think, the most compelling evidence to me as to why we need a change. But there are two other elements here. One is that it removes an excuse from the Castro regime as to why they remain so tightly controlled of their society. They were always able to, you know, cast the United States as the, you know, devil on the other side of the water, necessitating all of their backwards policies. Now they can't do that any longer. And third, and maybe most importantly, it changes the game throughout all of our hemisphere, right? So this embargo of Cuba, this isolation of Cuba, was becoming an irritant throughout Central and South America. It was coming to, you know, greatly hurt a lot of our relationships, was empowering countries like Venezuela. And so, you know, we will have much better relationships throughout the hemisphere, where still to this day most of our trade is happening because we've effectively taken Cuba off the table as something that hardliners in various places throughout Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean, can rally around.
When you sit down in the, I love to find out how it really works. When you sit down in the Foreign Relations Committee, which you serve on, do these kinds of things get debated there, or, you know, are they more political?
No, they largely get debated on the sidelines of that committee. So we've had some great debates on that committee. You know, this is one of the few truly functional committees that actually debates tough questions. You know, we passed an authorization for the use of military force against ISIL, which I voted for. We passed an authorization of military force in Syria, which I voted against. We debated Ukraine, passed a bill. And so that committee actually does debate. We often have closed-door sessions of members where we just get together and very quietly try to work things out. But we also have lots of side conversations. So a lot of my time on the Senate floor is spent, you know, huddling with, you know, John McCain or with Ron Johnson or Chris Coons or Tim Kaine, talking about what we're going to do in that committee next. So, you know, that's a fun committee, not just because the issues are so interesting, but because we're actually working and passing legislation as opposed to a lot of other committees that are locked down.
I know, Chris Murphy, that you've been interested in medical research and been concerned that there's such a precipitous decline in NIH funding in medical research. We all know how important that is. What's going on?
Well, you know, this is a consequence of these automatic budget cuts. So a few years ago, in order to avoid the Republicans from lurching the country into default on our debt, we had to agree to basically cut every account in the federal government by about 6 or 7% on an annual basis. It was madness. You know, instead of choosing what we want to spend money on and what we don't want to spend money on, we cut everything. Well, we amended that about a year ago to make the cut only about 2 or 3%. But to NIH, that's devastating, in part because it means that no new researchers get in the game. You just have enough money to sort of fund your existing projects. And so we are seeing more and more good, bright, young students in science not go into research because the word on the street is that, you know, the money is just not going to be there. And of course, it's about medical cures and creating better quality of life, but it's also where the jobs are going to be in this country. I mean, as I've talked to you before, I mean, my grandfather and great-grandfather worked at a, you know, ball bearing factory in New Britain. Well, those jobs are gone. But medical research jobs are going to be here because they're high-skill jobs. That's our bread and butter. And so when you're investing in scientific research, you're not just doing the right thing. You're also supporting the potential growth areas of our economy. So I've been shouting from the rooftops about this. There's a particular problem in Connecticut whereby Yale University, which is our big research engine, got a lot bigger cut than other major research institutions over the last year or so. So I'm trying to get NIH to correct that particular problem. But I'd rather that we just have a rising tide lifting all boats.
So don't the opponents know that, you know, they can live longer if we have research that shows what stem cells and other things will do?
Well, I think the opponents say, well, you know, the private sector is going to do this. Why do we have to put, you know, public money into research if the private sector does it? And, you know, the truth of the matter is that the private sector does a lot of research, but they do research into drugs that make them money, right? So, you know, they're doing, you know, research into, you know, female Viagra. They're not doing research into, you know, life-saving anti-cancer drugs, especially ones that are risky. It's the public sector that does the sort of baseline research that's far away from a cure. It's the public sector that does the riskier lines of research that aren't going to immediately return on investment. And I just think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the private sector is willing to do amongst a lot of people who support these cuts for NIH.
It's very interesting. But when we were kids, we used to say to each other, okay for you. Okay for you. And what happens is when we need a new antibiotic because the old ones are running out of steam, some of these folks are going to be very sorry.
Well, and here's the other thing we need to do, and this is a slightly separate conversation, but it's an important one. You know, the two ways that research gets funded in this world is by the United States government and by United States consumers, because we're the only country in the world that doesn't regulate the price of prescription drugs in the industrialized world other than New Zealand. That means that all of the R&D in the world is paid for by U.S. consumers. Everybody else is a free rider. And so the conversation has to be twofold. Yes, the U.S. government has to put in more money into research, but so do patients in Germany and China and Japan and France, who right now are paying super low costs for drugs, which is great for them, and they're getting all the benefits of these new cures, all paid for by, guess who? U.S. consumers. So that's another conversation we have to have.
I want to spend 1 minute on Greece. What do you make of that? You're on the Foreign Relations Committee. Is this goodbye for the European Union or what?
I don't think it is. You know, I think there's just a deep level of frustration in a lot of these countries on the edges of the European Union. And so this is, you know, watershed election. But the IMF seems committed to their version of quantitative easing, bond buying, that is going to, I think, be very helpful to a country like Greece. It may change some of the political equations there. But this is going to be a tough several months, tough year for the EU. Not a lot of signs of major economic growth there, and we're going to be watching a lot of countries, Greece at the top of the list, very carefully.
Greece has always been, and I only have a minute here, but Greece has always had a tremendous political influence in this country. Are you hearing from Greek constituents on any side of this?
You know, I do. I think, you know, a lot of people here are sort of watching the situation carefully, and I wouldn't say that, you know, I'm getting one side much louder than the other.
It's always wonderful to hear Senator Chris Murphy. He didn't forget us. He said when he was congressman, he'd come back when he was a senator. And Chris, we love you for it, and we appreciate your good words and your straight shooting answers to our questions.
I love coming on and doing it, and we'll keep it up.